I remember when it came out in 2017, I was recommending Douglas Murray's book, The Strange Death of Europe, to basically everyone I knew. And some of them, quite a lot of them actually, came back to me and said that they now viewed the world in a different light. But they were also so disconcerted by the book that they asked me to present a solution. What is to be done, Ivar? I didn't write the book, I answered. So bring it up with Douglas Murray or mail him. No, I actually tried to answer it, but I think Douglas Murray is better suited to answer the question. He's one of the foremost thinkers and writers of our time in my book. Not an actual book, but according to me. And he followed up The Strange Death of Europe 2 years later with The Madness of Crowds, which focused less on migration and Islam and more on the cultural issues afflicting us. And they are basically all centered around identity politics. So it has to do with gender, trans issues, race, etc., etc. And yesteryear, he came out with The War on the West, which is a follow-up, I would say, on the last one. And it's also more of a constructive book where he tries to answer the question that people posed to me when I recommended The Strange Death of Europe. What is to be done? And that's the book that we focus on in today's conversation. So why is the West waging a war on the West? Why are we so preoccupied with feeling guilty over stuff that happened long ago that we fail to notice our achievements as well? And how did anti-racism become racist? These questions and many more are the things that we discuss in today's podcasts. But now on to today's guest, Douglas Murray. You're listening to Rak Höger with me, Ivar Arpi. Welcome, Douglas Murray, to Rak Höger.
Very good to be with you.
It's an honor to have you on. And one of the reasons I've been very keen on having you on is because your three latest books really are some books I recommend, as I said before in the monologue. And your latest book is called War on the West, and it came out a year ago. And it's really ties into the book you wrote before, which was Madness of Crowds. It's sort of it takes it a step further. So I would just like to begin with this, like the stupid journalist question, like what is the War on the West, and why did you choose that title?
Well, in a number of recent books, as you say, I've been sort of groping towards what's going on in our time. In The Strange Death of Europe, I addressed the question of immigration and integration in the West, in particular in Europe. And this is obviously a subject which Swedes know very well, challenges around. And one of the things that I recognized that comes from mass migration and the great changing of a society is that the identity of society changes. You might like the direction of change, or you might dislike it, but it's pretty hard to argue against the simple proposition that if the people in the society change, the society changes. One of the ways in which our societies have changed has been that we've had to change our guiding ethos. And in my last but one book, The Madness of Crowds, I looked at one of the things that is a changing ethos, which is the way in which the sort of public religion of our time has become to do with identity and what has become known as identity politics, obsessions with LGBTQIA plus issues, obsessions with women and the place of women in society, an obsession with race and other identity-related issues. These have become the sort of the dominant issue in our societies, but I addressed that, as I say, in The Madness of Crowds. But there was an element of it that I had not addressed and which I wanted to address and did in my most recent book, In the War on the West, which is that in order for this to happen, you also, it appears, have to wage war on what we had in our societies. So to wage war on everything in our past, to effectively presume that everything that happened in the past was bad and must be lambasted, criticized. Now, in America, where we're all downstream these days, like it or not, from American culture, in America, this focuses in particular on the idea that America has an original sin, which is the sin of slavery. I don't deny the evils of slavery, but it's a very strange way to talk about it because, of course, if America has original sin, well, is it the only country that does? Or do other countries have original sins? What's the original sin of Uganda, for instance? We in Europe, in Britain and in Europe, have ended up imbibing our own version of this. And it comes in the form of anti-colonialism, the idea that, for instance, colonization is the original sin of Europe. In an obsession with slavery and any benefits that our societies had from that. And in a third thing as well, which is racism. To look at our societies and to look at them through the prism solely of racism. Again, racism is a part of our past, but it isn't the sole lens to look at it through. And yet that has become the case. And I say that this has become a form of Western anti-Westernism. And that's really what I write about in The War on the West. There are different types of anti-Westernism. There is Arab anti-Westernism. There is Chinese anti-Westernism. And these are very interesting and important subjects themselves. But the most important and the most dominant form of anti-Westernism in our time is, I believe, Western anti-Westernism. And that's really what I write about in this book. The West's hate for its own past.
It seems also... when you read your book, there is a profound lack of curiosity about the actual inheritance and history, and the people whose ideas have dominated or influenced our cultures for such a long time to understand them and put them in their proper historical context and understand where you come from. I mean, just. If you, I've been talking a lot about Christianity in this podcast lately. I've interviewed Tom Holland, Paul Kingsnorth, and a Swedish scientist on the subject. And so much of that knowledge about the Christian heritage, for example, is just, you can just brush it over now in school. It's just one religion out of many. And why should we learn more about that than others, the other great world religion? And of course, that's an But the lack of curiosity seems. I'm not sure if you share that sentiment and why, if you're going to criticize, my own perspective is that if you're going to criticize something, you better learn a lot about it and then you take it apart.
But why would you have to learn anything if you thought you already knew everything? I mean that's what's really happening is that you see, if you believe that everything that's gone wrong in the world is our fault in the West, you don't need to educate yourself about the rest of the world, and you don't really have to educate yourself about your own past because you've already got this monomaniacal view of it, this single lens through which you need to look at everything. Believing that everything was bad and that's all you need to know. Whereas to be informed, you would need to at least know the pros and the cons, the upsides and the downsides, the virtues and the vices. For instance, if you were to be interested in the historic subject of slavery, you would need to know both the ways in which it was done, the people involved, including the Africans involved and the African nations involved. And you would also have to know that it was the West that actually abolished slavery and how that came about, including the Christian religious impulse that brought it to an end. You know, the Christian campaigners who brought it to an end. Now, if you believe that
could you just say who? I think that part, perhaps my listeners know about that part, but it's not well known, actually. That's one of the things that people are very not so curious about, is why did the West abolish slavery and Britain in particular?
Well, it's a very interesting subject. I mean, in Britain, the anti-slavery movement was dominated by Christians who recognized slavery. I mean, slavery has been a consistent throughout human history. Almost every civilization we know of engaged in some form of it. It was the norm. Principally, I hate this, makes me sound jingoistic, but when the British abolished slavery in the 19th century, it was largely done through a moral argument whose moral force became impossible to resist. And the moral force came from a Christian idea of the sanctity of the individual, and that this sanctity applied to everyone, that everyone was equal in the eyes of God, and that man did not have the right to enslave his fellow man. Now, the moral force of this argument, made by people like Wilberforce and others, as I say, became impossible to resist. And became so impossible to resist that actually, you know, slavery fell apart within a number of decades. It didn't fall apart simply through natural causes or from the force of that argument. It also stopped because the British Navy patrolled the high seas and forcibly stopped vessels transporting slaves, for instance, to Brazil, which tried to continue slaving until the 1880s. So it was not simply through a force of moral argument, but the initial impetus to ban slavery, and to ban it not just in the British Empire as it then was, but around the world, undoubtedly had a Christian Christian fuel behind it. I mean, that's a very important thing to recognize. There's another one that comes with, perhaps a more complicated one morally, which is the Christian realization that was at the root of a form of colonialism, and certainly in the age of the explorers existed. When Columbus and others set out, Columbus in particular, and accidentally discovered the new world, one of the interesting questions that arises is what the natives in these places, what they were, and if the West had approached them in the way that many people think, among other things, no missionary would have set out. It was the insight, actually, of European explorers that said these people are like us. That's obvious to us today, but it wasn't obvious at the time. And many other civilizations would have taken a contrary view. But the moment that people realized these were people like us, people with immortal souls, to use the language of the time, then, of course, the missionaries set out. And the missionaries would not have set out if these were not recognized to be, as it were, equals.
I mean, in 1807, while Britain was fighting Napoleon, and it was before everything was decided and Napoleon was vanquished, the British Parliament passed the Act of the Abolition of the Slave Trade, and as you say, the British Navy, to a great cost, actually, for the British Empire. Of course, the argument is that it was the white savior complex and all that, and that's part of it. But it was also the case that it was at a great cost that the British Empire fought a lot of wars to abolish the slave trade. And I remember a friend of mine who has roots from Africa, from his father's side, and he was on a panel talking about slavery and colonialism. And he said, actually, all you guys who are here, most of you guys here are white. So you have sort of inherited a sense of guilt for the slave trade. but my family actually, we actually owned and sold slaves for centuries. And we only stopped because the Britain abolished the slave trade. That's the reason we stopped. And so I have an actual sort of inherited guilt from my family. But since I am black in your in the eyes of this kind, I have the upper hand towards you because even though you were potato farmers recently. But that kind of argument is too complex for the, as you say, also, I mean, we're just focusing on one specific here, but it's interesting that you're actually not interested in how these Quakers and Christians and British politicians like Wilberforce argued for the, and before that, Bartolomé Las Casas, about the that these souls were worth saving. They were part of the common humanity, and of course there was a brutal people, conquistadors and all that as well, and genocides, but that you're only interested in the worst part of the Western history. And it seems like we are ourselves, as you say, there's a Western war against the West, and it's hard to understand why.
Well, it's a very interesting, as I say, the why is partly because it's so simple, it's so straightforward, it's such a simple narrative. And as you say, the reality is complex. The reality, for the real story, you have to know more. I mean, it would be absurd to, for instance, look at the history of Africa and look at it solely through the lens of racism and slavery. I mean, you could do, but by the way, if you did, I think people would recognize you had a certain animus against the peoples of that continent. I think it's the same with the anti-Westernism. I think there's an animus against the West that is revealed in this, that you're obsessed with this aspect of our past, suggests that actually you have a problem with the West as a whole because you want to focus only on the bad. If you did that with anyone, I think people would question your motives. They would say, why? Why can't you understand us in the round? And another example of that animus is actually something you mentioned in passing there. Phrases like the white savior complex. This is a lose-lose situation that's been deliberately set up by people who I believe are simply antagonistic towards the West and its history. The lose-lose situation is if you've done something bad, you're blamed. And if you do something good, you're said to be, for instance, a white savior. What way out is there in this? And the answer is none. It's a trap. Don't fall into it. Anyone talking in that kind of language is inviting you to fail. It is inviting you into a trap which you cannot get out of.
I mean, there are people, when I studied sociology, which is a very interesting subject if you read the authors, but the people who study it are sometimes, it was a very left-wing, postmodern, post-colonial environment. But there are people who are just thought that I'm going to go out in the world and I'm just going to tell them about human rights and they'll know and then they'll understand how to live their lives, basically. And then they went out into the world and they were disappointed in the people they they encountered. So, I mean, there's perhaps a kernel of truth in it. But if we once, like 100 years ago, if you look demographics and you look at Europe, then a much larger portion of the world's population was living in Europe. And what we define as the West, it was much more powerful in all measures of power, economics, demographics, everything. So then you could, if the great powers of Europe came together and decided something, then the rest of the world had to basically obey, or they could fight, but they would probably lose. And now we're in a situation where that's not the case anymore. I would argue that the West has declined to a large degree, and we have, if you count the West as a whole. I mean, we have China as a rising power, and we have had challenges to Western power throughout the world. And is this sort of this guilt and the warring on the West by the West, is this sort of a backhanded way to keep our self-image as all-powerful or something? I mean, like, it's our fault. Everything's our fault.
Well, there's a part of it that is the case, certainly. I would argue that one of the virtues, what has become known as the West, is self-criticism, self-critique. I think it's a vital part of the West's success, economic, military, social, and much more, is the desire to improve, the desire to hear arguments against yourself in the hope of getting better. That's not by any means a universal virtue. There are many societies around the world who do not, have not engaged in that kind of self-criticism. And I think that has an effect on the society itself. However, the problem of self-criticism is that it itself can get into overreach, and it gets into overreach and moves from being a virtue into being a vice when it moves from self-criticism to self-laceration and then to self-loathing. And one of the questions that has occasionally come up since the War of the West came out has been, people have said to me, well, how can you tell when a society moves from self-criticisms to self-laceration to self-destruction? And I say, well, it's in the same way that we all can tell it in our own lives. We've all developed an ability to distinguish between critics who wish us well and critics who wish us ill. I think everyone listening has had the experience of their own lives of hearing from people who criticize them in order to help them, and people who criticize who are simply people who dislike. If somebody gave me advice who I knew loved me, I would listen to the advice. If it was somebody who I knew loathed me, I think I'd be less likely to. How can I tell the difference? It's not hard. It's not hard, and I don't think it's that hard in a society either. I think, as I say, for instance, if somebody starts talking about original sins of your society, of guilt that is ineradicable and solely yours, who speaks in terms of white savior complexes and much more, you're dealing with somebody who doesn't want to improve you. You're dealing with somebody who wants to end you, who loathes you, loathes your society. That is not a hard thing to identify. It's there in all the language that is being used and in the campaigns that are being fought.
One of the most concerning things about, especially the Anglo-Saxon countries, if you include, or Anglophone countries, English-speaking countries, is the woke takeover of institutions such as universities, the media, and any number of schools for young elementary schools. And now you go through in this book and the last, The Madness of Crowds, the critical race theory and what it basically, what does it really say? Because, I mean, critical race theory, doesn't sound that bad if you don't know what it is. Just critical way to discuss theory, race theory, and they describe themselves as anti-racists, of course. But I mean, if you take the most popular books and the most popular authors, and their books are bestsellers, and they're being recommended in bookstores here in Sweden, and it's being, of course, it's more widespread in the United States and probably in United Kingdom as well, and just how can theories that are so counter to what we, who are a little bit older, grew up to believe was anti-racism, basically don't be so shallow, be colorblind. That's the famous pop song from No Vogue. And that was colorblindness. That was the way to go. And now it's the opposite. And it's not just the opposite. Yes. It's also that you should, there is no good way to be white for an author as Robin DiAngelo. And for Ibram X. Kendi, he goes even further than she does. So how has such extreme theories gotten such a hold of our societies?
Well, one explanation is that we're living in an age of overcorrection. And this is the most benevolent interpretation that I can give. Overcorrection is something I addressed in The Madness of Crowds in relation to social issues. You see, for instance, nobody can deny that in the past, historically, women had fewer opportunities than men. But that's something that almost everybody in our societies today wishes to rectify. But there is a group of people who do not want to settle on equality between the sexes, but want to, as it were, make up for lost time by overcorrecting and socking it to the men for a while. To say, for instance, well, women were prejudiced against in the past, so let's be prejudiced against men for a time. Overcorrections like that seem to be pretty common in our societies in this century. Trying to make up for historic wrongs, perceived or actual, by overcorrecting in the present. The most striking version of this is the one that you just referred to, which is, again, nobody can deny that historically and to some extent today that racism exists. It's one of, I think, a number of human evils which we should all be aware of and, as I say, try to resist. And the settlement we had broadly come to, as you say, when some of us were growing up, was colorblindness as an aspiration, which is to get to the point, as my friend Sam Harris has put it, that skin color would be as unimportant as hair color, for instance. Well, again, there seem to be people who wish to go through an overcorrection. They wish to say, because in white-dominated societies, white-majority societies, as ours in Europe, the West, have been, because there has been prejudice against black people in the past, we must rectify that in the present, not by equality, but by socking it to the white people for a bit, by being unpleasant to the white people for a time. This is, I believe, a completely suicidal route to go down for many reasons, one of which is that you are warring against the majority in your population. And I don't think that's ever a recipe for success. But nevertheless, it's the vengeful period that we are in which things are said about white people that would be tolerated if they were said about other people, not at all. I mean, if, for instance, you quoted the appalling Robin DiAngelo, she says, as you say, that there's no good way to be white. Just flip that around and imagine how abhorrent it would be and how appalled we would all be if Miss DiAngelo or anyone else said there's no good way of being black. We would be appalled. Or there's no good way of being Asian, something like that. It would be appalling. You'd be saying, what are you setting people up for in their lives? This would be identified quite rightly as racism. Well, it is and should be identified as racism in this case too. It's quite appalling the tone in which people like Kendi and DiAngelo and others are allowed to talk about a whole races of people. I'm amazed they've got away with it, but they certainly have so far, and I want them not to. I mean, there are even people. There's a book by a professor in America called Colorblind Racism that asserts that the very principle of colorblindness is itself racist. Well, that again gets you into this lose-lose situation.
I think that's brilliant. That's a brilliant, brilliant way. Even to try to stop seeing race—that's also racism. That's there's no escape.
No escape. They've barred all of the exits while setting the house on fire. Yeah. That's what these people have done. And it's one of the things that I'm calling them out for in the War on the West, and what I want to identify for my readers as a major challenge that we have to address.
And of course, there's people like me who've perhaps had an ideal of colorblindness and integration. And then when you face, in Swedish institutions, we have, some things are a little bit different. Race is not as prevalent, but gender and sex and trans issues are very prevalent. So it's like a different, the mix is the same, but it's just an...
they have slightly different emphases, yes.
Yes, exactly. But then you start to think that, maybe if we are the only ones upholding the liberal principles of equal treatment, meritocracy, non-discrimination, for example, but the other side are fighting tooth and nail to have their candidates on the board or their policies enacted, then we're going to lose. So how do you keep people from not just, okay, maybe I am white? And I myself remember the first time I really reflected on me being white, because for me it was like an American phenomenon that you could see on television. And it was not that long ago. It was like 20 years ago or something. I reflected, I'm white. I think I was reading in the sociology class I was referring to. And somebody said it, and I was like, okay, yeah. So I'm not just an ethnic Swede. I'm white. Because, of course, there's a biological core of some of these concepts, but they are also socially constructed. And then you start to identify with them and then become a sort of a reality for people. And we are really, that's something that has happened quite late in Sweden because we didn't have. But how do you keep, I know Eric Kaufman has written about this in White Shift. I've had him on. Yeah. And he said like, okay, but there's a legitimate way to be, if other groups are waging identity politics, the majority has a right to do it themselves. What's your take on that?
My own view is that this way lies hell, but it might be unavoidable if people keep going the way they're going. I don't want to identify by my skin color, and I don't. I mean, if you were to say, Douglas, how do you think about yourself? I would first of all say, well, I don't very much. I don't sit around pondering.
That's refreshing.
I don't sit around pondering. You know, I know I don't sit around pondering myself, you know, but if you're to say, well, who are you or how do you identify yourself? I'd have an awful lot of things to say, probably starting with, well, I'm a writer, but I don't think that at any point, I mean, or at least it would be quite certainly a very long way down the list. Would I say, well, I'm white. I don't think it would actually be in my list particularly. I just don't think of myself in that way and don't like to think of myself in that way. And I think most people, liberal-minded, for want of a better term, people in the West also don't want to think in those terms. They don't want to be made to be white. It's reductive. It's got all sorts of implications. But if you push people endlessly, that might well be one of the places that they will go to. And Eric Kaufman says, you know, well, it's a sort of legitimate, understandable endpoint in this. I agree with the provision that I think that it's a very undesirable endpoint. I don't think the re-racialization of society is a desirable thing, but it's certainly something that is going on. And I don't want people to be pushed into identifying in this way. But I say at the end of the War on the West, I give an example of, you know, the options that are available. And anyone who reads the conclusion to the book will see the rather stark way in which I lay this out.
Yeah. One of the things that's at the core of your three latest books that were mainly talking about The Strange Death of Europe, The Madness of Crowds, and The War of the West is what is the West, and why is it worth defending? And in The Strange Death of Europe, what was very, I wrote about it when it came out, and I recommended it to people, and people later confronted me with it. Like, this was, why did you recommend this book? I'm depressed now. Because, of course, it's a very somber book in a lot of ways. It's in the title that Europe is killing itself in a lot of ways. And but one of the main arguments that you have in the book is that Europe itself has lost faith in its beliefs, traditions, and legitimacy. But that's also what you explore in The War on the West. Like, it's not even legitimate.
Yes.
But why is it worth defending then?
Well, my own belief is that it remains worth defending because it's still by a long way the best of all available options. If you look at the alternative dominant systems in the 21st century, I think all of them are infinitely less desirable than the systems that exist in what has come to be known as the West. I don't believe that, for instance, the Chinese Communist Party's vision of the future is a desirable one. It's certainly not one I would want to live under. But it is an alternative scenario in which a degree of financial opportunity exists, a very minimal, but a degree of it, and in which personal freedom is not regarded as being of any particular significance. I mean, the things that we take for granted, like personal liberty, like human rights, are, and again, some people think this is a shocking thing to say, but nevertheless, it remains true. These are Western concepts, the Western constructs. They are things that came from the West. And, you know, as I say, people might wish to argue that or resile from even asserting that. But nevertheless, it remains true. And anyone who actually cares about some of the subjects we've been discussing ought to reflect very seriously on whether or not they are, in their critiques of our societies, not engaging in that fallacy that, I mean, Immanuel Kant famously gives in the example of the dove that flies in free air, that may mistake the resistance of the wind and think that in the absence of this wind that it would be able to fly faster, when in actual fact the thing that is what keeps it up. I mean, another analogy would be the fish that believes it would swim faster if it weren't for the water. You know, perhaps there are a lot of people in our societies, and I put it no stronger than this, perhaps there are a lot of people in our societies who are making this fundamental category error of thinking that if it weren't for the system that is around them, they would be going so much further and faster. And I think this is a delusion. There are certainly things that we can improve in our societies in the West, but the idea that the whole system itself needs replacing or anything like it is a very serious mistake to make. Because, as I say, the alternatives that are on offer are highly undesirable.
And I mean, if you look at, for example, I know you were in a panel with Tom Holland, and you spoke about the role of Christianity. And I know you were a friend of Christopher Hitchens, and you've described yourself as an reformed Anglican turned atheist. And but in that debate, when I heard you didn't sound triumphant, so to speak. And I know Tom Holland himself says that he sort of wished he could go the whole yard, but he recognizes the role Christianity has played in the West, and I think this is a more and more common recognition by public intellectuals such as yourself that maybe we've emphasized Enlightenment philosophy, liberalism, and that part of our tradition too much and paid too little attention and given too little credit to Christianity. And now that our societies are more and more secular, or at least the majority populations are, and then what is there, what I'm trying to come at is there a core missing here, so to speak, of what it means to be a Westerner?
Yes, I think there is, and it's something we've seen in the last 20 years in particular. I think that one of the results of 9/11 was a form of strident atheism that found, for instance, and I was a part of this, but found in a way that one of the ways to criticize growing dominance of Islam in our societies was to criticize religion as a whole. I think that's one of the things that went on in the 2000s. And although in the case of Islam, that remained difficult to do, in the case of Christianity, the atheists were pushing at a pretty open door. It was already fragile. I think that, without in any way speaking for my late friend, I think that one of the things that's happened in the last 10 years has been a greater reflection, which you can see in the work of Tom Holland and others, a greater reflection on what you just laid out, which is, yes, you know, part of our inheritance is the Enlightenment, part of it is reason, rationalism, inheritance of ancient Greece, and much more. But it is also the inheritance of Christianity. And people were, 20 years ago, that seemed to be a slightly harder thing to assert than it is now. But I think that the work of, I mean, for instance, Larry Seedentop, a distinguished political philosopher who wrote a book some years ago called Inventing the Individual, without in any way being a dogmatic Christian himself, Larry Seedentop proves that, you know, I mean, again, concepts that we take for granted as the water we swim in, concepts in our society are to a great extent a Christian inheritance. Now, you know, again, people might like that or dislike it, but it's the case, whether you like it or not. And we need to have a truthful understanding of ourselves, and not one based on falsehoods that we just happen to enjoy.
I mean, one argument that's been made, it's also that what we call woke, which is it's a broad term, but it's an umbrella term, and it incorporates many of the things that we've been talking about: CRT, LGBTQ issues, trans rights, equity, diversity, basically. But it's also a view on power and who are the powerful, who are the powerless, and who deserves justice and stuff like that. But that is sort of the God-shaped hole that's left behind by Christianity, and woke moves in there, and it sort of gives you structure to the world. Yes. To your place in it. And it also has some of the concepts like guilt, original sin. I mean, you could see these scenes from after George Floyd was killed by that policeman. You could see the scenes of white people washing the feet of black people. And it was sort of a Christian, in a Christian tradition, but it sort of also was not, because
here's the thing that's not. I agree with your observation. I regard a lot of these modern social movements as being forms of spilt Christianity, or residue Christianity, which the people engaging in it don't recognize and would be quite annoyed by if told this. Nevertheless, as you say, very visible, recognizable aspects of Christianity are interwoven in this. But here's the difference, and here's the fatally important difference. What is being offered at the moment is a form of secularized Christianity without any ethic of redemption. And that is dangerous, very, very dangerous. The great brilliance of Christianity is the concept of redemption, the possibility of atoning for sins, successfully atoning for sins. Take away the possibility of successful atonement, and all you have is a perpetual cycle of guilt. And I believe that is what underlies a lot of the unhappiness in our societies today, is, okay, I'm told I'm evil, evil from birth. I'm told I'm guilty, guilty from birth. And I'm told that my very existence is some kind of insult or assault on the planet. I mean, that's part of the green movement as well, is my very being here is part of the problem. And there's no way out other than to live a life of complete innocuousness or harmlessness. Yeah. That was something that Jordan Peterson and I have discussed in the past. And indeed, I raised with Roger Scruton in what was sadly his last public appearance. Roger and I discussed this as well, this idea that harmlessness had become the sort of great modern virtue, that you were meant to slip into this world and slip out of it without having made any mark. It's certainly done no harm. This is a highly demoralizing state of affairs to be in, but it is a dominant one that is being pushed on people. I don't like it at all. I want people to be extraordinary and successful and innovative and much more. I don't want them to live lives. I don't want us to live lives of thwartedness, of repression, of as I say, of guilt without redemption. I think it's a hideous system.
Yeah, and I think the redemption in Christianity, sometimes there's been a criticism that it's too easy sometimes. I mean, that you can get...
Well, they haven't tried it hard then.
No, exactly. And that you can get forgiveness. You just go to confession in a Catholic. This is my Swedish Lutheran upbringing. That you just
I was going to say, that's a recognizably Protestant. That's a recognizably Protestant critique of Catholicism. Yes.
Exactly. You just get forgiveness right away.
Yeah. But real forgiveness in the Christian sense is an awesome thing to behold when you really meet it. I mean, a few years ago, to cite a pertinent example, there was a white American youth who went into a black church and shot at congregants and killed a lot of them. And it was a hideous crime of a kind that is uncommon, but happens.
And his motive was to kill black people, if I don't remember.
Yes. And some of the families of the people who were killed, who were murdered, said that they did not hate the killer. They forgave him. Now, I mean, that's almost beyond my comprehension. I'm overwhelmed with admiration for anyone who could even aspire to such a state of grace, actually, for want of a better term, perhaps there isn't a better term. So, as I say, actual forgiveness is in the Christian is an awesome thing to behold when it is actually exercised, and should not be taken lightly.
I think there's a movie from the 80s that I remember the scene. It's Robert De Niro, Jeremy Irons, Liam Neeson in The Mission. It's called The Mission. It's from 1986, and Robert De Niro plays like a Spanish adventurer, and he goes to Jeremy Irons and Liam Neeson, they are Jesuits who live in the, who are trying to save, as we talked about in the beginning, they're trying to save the indigenous people's souls then and convert them to Christianity. And Jeremy Irons plays a flute, and they often did, Jesuits brought musical instruments because that was like magic to some of the people who had never heard it before. But Robert De Niro takes them as slaves, and they just rob them and rape and like all the most hideous. So there's two aspects of European imperialism present at the same time. And in the end, then yes, Jeremy Irons brings Robert De Niro to the tribe that he's been killing, and he's been kidnapping people into slavery, and he converts him. And Robert De Niro breaks down, mm-hmm, because all the indigenous, the tribe gathers around him, and they could easily kill him if they wanted to. But instead they laugh and hug him, and he starts crying, and he's saved in the Christian sense. Mm-hmm. So that's a redemption, because he's, of course, he deserves, mm-hmm, I would say, to be killed or something, punished for what he's done. Mm. But instead, that's his redemption arc then. Mm. And it's been criticized because it has a colonial view and yada, yada, yada. But it's also, it shows the very, like, Christian redemption 101. You're an awful person, and then you stop because of forgiveness. And I mean, and this is totally lacking in this new woke religion, because of course, as we've been talking about, there is no way out, so to speak. Your presence, if you have certain characteristics, such as being white or having a certain sexual orientation, or your presence destroys the fun for everyone, so to speak.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that's also part of the victim hierarchy. Is the aspiration to victimhood, which again I have very little sympathy with, because I believe that our lives can be much better than simply trying to be victims. It is one of the anomalies of the last generation that we have moved the public ethic from an admiration for heroism into an admiration for suffering. Mm. And what it means is there's a scramble to suffer or to claim suffering. Nobody actually wants to suffer. They want to claim to have suffered, and because to do so is to hold the microphone, to have the right to hold the microphone. But yes, what you describe correctly as the situation which we find ourselves in Western societies is what a chess-playing friend of mine tells me in chess is known as Zugzwang, which is that you have to move, but every move will make your position worse. That's the position we find ourselves in, and it's one I want to break, and I'm very explicit about that. I believe that this system that we're describing, the anti-Westernism and the wokeness and much more, it is a system that we should aspire to break in order that people can move on with their lives and move on to better things.
Just to wrap it up a little bit, perhaps. I think that the conversations you've had with Jordan Peterson and Roger Scruton about being harmless, this is certainly very true about men, boys and men in our culture. And you're very scared about masculinity and about, you're scared of men, really, and you have to keep them down, so to speak. And
yeah,
I'd like to hear your thoughts about that, and if there is a way out of it. Is there a way out of making pathologizing men, and what is the legacy of Me Too, do you think?
Well, yes, I mean, I address the overreach of Me Too, which I think it is an overreach, an overcorrection. I addressed that in The Madness of Crowds. I believe you cannot, or you should not, make all interactions between men and women a sort of minefield that we've made them. You know, men can do terrible things to women, but
they don't do it all the time, and not everything is terrible. You know, it should be possible for a man to make an advance on a woman and be rejected, and for that to be the end of the matter. Again, there has to be a way to have a bad date, for instance. Men should not be in a society set up in such a position as they have the opportunity to make one move once on a woman, and it has to be 100% successful, and they have to hit the bullseye on the, you know, the first throw, and this has to be the person they marry, and so on. I mean, I'm afraid that everyone who knows the dating game knows that that's highly unlikely to happen. Mistakes are going to happen, and you have to have a reasonable view towards that, which includes forgiveness and moving on and much more. Well, that's quite different from when somebody behaves genuinely badly. But I believe all of this has been wrapped up in this, into being the same thing. And it's very dangerous, because it makes relations between the sexes all but impossible. And somebody who would like our species to continue, I think that men and women have to be able to find a way to get on.
Yeah. And this really ties into the, I did a mistake to ask two questions in one, but this ties into the first question I tried to ask. And because, of course, you have to take a step back then to take the consent. And we also have a new consent law, or quite new in Sweden. So you have to prove that you had consent instead of proving that you said no. If there's a situation where of an accused rape or something, so you have to take a step back now as a man out of precautions, and as a young man, because they are of course looking for a partner and looking for women. So what can be done to the situation for men right now? Because I think we put them in a quite of a bad situation, and there is a lot of debates in Sweden where you first you ridicule men because they're too soft. I've certainly sometimes been guilty of that, and then you ridicule them or are angry with them when they try to be tougher, and you ridicule men who are sensitive and vulnerable, because they take too much space then from and too much attention from people who deserve it more, women. And then if they're too hard and don't show any feelings, then they're toxic. So how can you solve this?
It's not a good time to be young and heterosexual. I believe this all has to be addressed and solved, because otherwise, I mean, all of the stats show, all the data shows that an increasing number of young men in particular are basically stepping out of the whole system. I mean, the evidence on the number of people who've had sex in the past year and so on shows an increasing tendency towards young men basically stepping out of the system. Thinking it's just all too difficult, too toxic, and giving women a very wide berth. Again, I think this is a creation of a form of feminism, which those people who created it will live to regret, or at least the people who come after them will live to regret. It has to be solved.
And last, I would just end on, I think I mentioned this in the podcast previously, but I was in there's a charge that all this that we've been talking about, this is peripheral, and the thinkers you bring up, they are okay, they're academics, and they sell a few books, but is it really something to take seriously? And and the same here, I've written books about these subjects, and you try to bring up the empirical data and stories, and you find these cases of people being silenced or abused, and then they say just anecdotes. It's just anecdotes. That's the critical view of it. But I just visited Åland, which is an archipelago, but with a big island in the middle, in between Sweden and Finland, and it's 30,000 people, and they are pretty independent from Finland, and they all speak Swedish, so they look to Sweden. And now when I was there and I was having a lecture with my co-author, Anna-Karin Windham, and we spoke about these issues, and just the same day we were there, they were debating to vote through a law that will have gender-neutral pregnancies. So why is a tiny island in the north where many of the questions concerns, like, okay, there's been a great snowfall. We have to do something about, we have to make it work. Or there's like practical issues. These politicians are dealing with practical issues. And all of a sudden, the most woke things are being debated in their quite small parliament.
Absolutely. And that's the story of our era. And it's happened everywhere. And people, I don't care for the people who underestimate it. It seems to me that they haven't left the house very much in recent years. It's everywhere. And it's a great waste of time and energy. My goodness, there are so many other things that are more important to be getting on with. So many bigger challenges that are literally on our doorsteps.
Do you feel like you're wasting your time then? Because you've written brilliant books, but you've written brilliant books about stupid people.
Well, my hope is that I help to clear them out of the way. That's one of my self-appointed tasks, is to clear these people out of the way, help my readers clear these people out of the way, in order that people can get on to doing what they should be doing with their lives. And that's really what I want to do. And if I have any success in my life, it'll be in helping people to do that.
Thank you, Douglas Murray, for being part of Rak Höger.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you.
Och stort tack till dig som har lyssnat. Gå gärna in och skriv en recension på Apple Podcasts eller i den app där du lyssnar på podden. Och detta är alltså en del av en större publikation på Substack med samma namn som podden. Och den som prenumererar där kan även ta del av de texter jag skriver. Gillar man det man läser och hör får man gärna bli betalande prenumerant för 5 euro i månaden eller 50 om året. Då får man ta del av lite exklusivt extra material också. Du hittar rubbet på ivararpi.se. Och har du några frågor eller synpunkter kan du alltid mejla mig på ivararpi@substack.com. Vi hörs igen.